Chapter 24, On the Outside. Sitting there, reading that list, I felt completely alone in the world. What could I do? Would Billy turn everyone against me? How could I defend myself? I couldn't prove that I wasn't a spy, so how could I convince them? And what if Churchill decided to intern Germans under 16 too? Would I be taken away to a prison camp? I stayed there until Auntie Rose called me in for tea. I was dreading facing them all and having to pretend to be normal. But their attention was on other things. They had just heard on the BBC that the Germans had reached the port of Calais on the French coast. 20 miles away, exclaimed Auntie Rose. To think those evil men are only 20 miles from Kent. It doesn't seem possible. I sat, frozen, ice cold with terror. Nowhere was safe anymore. Images flashed through my mind. Nazi jackboots marching through Ashcombe, swastikas hanging from the flagpoles. What would they do to me? Are you all right, Anna? Asked Auntie Rose. You're as white as a sheet. Don't you feel well? No, I said. I might go and lie down. My legs shook when I stood up. I gripped the banister rail as I walked upstairs. My heart raced and my head spun. If the Nazis came, I would have to run. I wouldn't let them catch me and I couldn't get the Deans in trouble. I would go and hide in the woods. No, they would search the woods with dogs and guns. I would go to London. I had no money for the train fare, but there must be ways to sneak on without paying. I could pretend to be an orphan. Somebody would look after me, surely. Bloomsbury House! I would go to Bloomsbury House, where the Refugee Committee had their offices. One of those ladies would take care of me. I pulled my little case from under my bed and packed my clothes, along with Heidi and ballet shoes. I looked at the box of my parents' letters on the bedside table. Molly would notice if that was gone. I would have to put it in the case at the last minute. I made a space for it at the side. I slid the case back under the bed. My heart was still thumping, but I felt slightly calmer. At least I had a plan. The next week at school was really horrible. People huddled in corners, whispering and shooting glances in my direction. When I walked past them, they nudged each other and stared at me. My friends still stuck by me, though. At least, none of them said or did anything nasty, but I could tell they were thinking things that they weren't telling me. The war news was getting even worse. The Germans trapped the retreating British and French armies at Dunkirk on the Normandy coast. As well as the Navy, lots of people were crossing the Channel in little boats to bring the soldiers home, and it seemed that everybody in the village was waiting for news of their men. On Sunday afternoon, Auntie Rose asked me and Molly to go with her to visit Mrs. Digweed, an elderly widow. Poor woman, both of her sons are out in France and she's beside herself waiting for news, Auntie Rose said. You two will be a nice distraction for her. We took her some eggs and a jar of plum jam. As we drew near to the crossroads by the church and the war memorial, we saw the air raid patrol warden and another man, Joe Thomas, digging a hole around the signpost. Gosh, said Molly, they're doing it already. We had heard on the news yesterday that the government had ordered every signpost in the country to be taken down, so if German parachutists landed, they wouldn't know where they were. The warden took hold of the white painted post and wobbled it. It had four arms on the top, printed with the names of the neighbouring villages. That should do it, I reckon, he said to Mr. Thomas. Let's give it a go. Mr. Thomas straightened up and laid down his spade. Both men grasped the post and heaved it out of the ground. Hello, Mrs. Dean, called a woman's voice. We turned to see Miss Marshall coming out of the church, carrying a stack of parish magazines. We all said hello, and then Miss Marshall said, I thought I'd better take these. There's not much point removing the signposts if a parachutist can just walk into the church and find the name of the village printed on the front of the magazine. Goodness, yes, said Auntie Rose. I hadn't thought of that. I shivered at the thought of a Nazi parachutist striding into the village church. Miss Marshall must have noticed, because she gave me a rather strained smile. Ignore me, Anna. I'm just being silly. I hope you're not worrying about all these rumours of parachutists and such like. People are getting a bit hysterical at the moment. It didn't seem hysterical to me. It seemed completely realistic. How could Miss Marshall sound so calm? Didn't she know what would happen to her if the Germans invaded? When I was 9, we had walked into our classroom one Monday morning to find a man in a black suit standing at the front. He held a cane in his hand. He told us he was our teacher now, and his name was Herr Molson. "But where's Frau Schmidt?" asked Klaus. We all liked Frau Schmidt. She was decent and fair, and she rarely used her cane. And after that girl had spat at me, Frau Schmidt had patrolled the playground every break time. "Frau Schmidt has left the school," Herr Molson said. He wore a swastika badge on his jacket. He made me and Esther, the only other Jewish student, sit at the back of the classroom, with an empty row of desks between us and the other children, as though being Jewish was an infectious disease. He told the class that every time he walked into the room, we must all stand up and raise our right arms in the Hitler salute. He demonstrated it, stabbing his right arm straight out in front of him, palm down. "Heil Hitler!" he shouted. "Heil Hitler!" shouted everyone except me and Esther. My stomach was jumping with nerves, but I kept my head down and my arms by my side. Papa had told me I never had to say those words. Then I glanced up and caught Herr Molson's eye. He was glaring at me with such a look of hatred that I shuddered and lowered my head again. You at the back, raise your hands. To my astonishment, Esther slowly raised her hand. "Heil Hitler," she mumbled. My mouth was dry. I was trembling with fear, petrified that Herr Molson would stride across the classroom and strike me with his cane. "Sit down," he said, "and take out your books." I risked another glance at him. He wasn't looking at me. I sat down and took out my book. Herr Molson never looked at me or spoke to me again. It was as though he had decided I didn't exist. And at break time that day, I discovered that the rest of the class had taken their cue from him. None of the other children, not even Ingrid, would play with me, speak to me, or even look at me. They acted as though I was invisible. When I tried to speak to them, they simply turned their backs and carried on their conversations. My parents could tell something was wrong, but when they asked me, I said everything was fine. I didn't want to make them more worried than they already were. Now, today, I looked at Miss Marshall, talking to Auntie Rose. Did she realise that if the Germans invaded, she would be replaced by a teacher who would turn all the children into Nazis? "I'm glad I've seen you, Mrs. Dean," she said. "I wanted to let you know how wonderfully Anna's getting on at school. Her progress is really remarkable. Her English is almost flawless, and she's doing superbly in her other subjects too." I didn't dare glance at Molly. "I never asked for praise," I wanted to tell her. "I just want to learn." "Molly's doing extremely well too," said Miss Marshall, to my great relief. "I'm very keen that both of them try for a scholarship to the grammar school next year. They're such bright girls, it would be a terrible waste of their potential to leave school at 14. "Oh, well," said Auntie Rose uncomfortably, "I'm not sure. Isn't the uniform very expensive? And then there's all the books they'd need." "I'm sure there's something we could do about that. I'll have a think. Perhaps Bloomsbury House might be able to help with Anna's expenses." "I don't know," said Auntie Rose. "They don't seem to have a lot of money for luxuries." "Education isn't a luxury, Mrs. Dean," said Miss Marshall. "Maybe, but fancy uniforms and Latin textbooks certainly feel like luxuries when your children are wearing shoes they've grown out of and you've no idea how you're going to afford new ones for the winter." "Yes, of course," said Miss Marshall. "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cause offence." "None taken," said Auntie Rose, forcing a smile. "You were just doing your job, and it is lovely to hear how well the girls are doing." But her face was clouded over as we walked to Mrs. Digweed's house. Mrs. Digweed had just had a postcard from her younger son to say he was safely back in England and would be coming to see her next week. Her happiness cheered us all up, and we left her with hopeful assurances that she would be bound to hear from her other boy very soon. As we walked back, we saw the greengrocer outside his shop balance precariously at the top of a ladder. He was painting out the village name on his sign. Now it just said, "Greengrocers." We looked at the neighbouring shops and saw that their signs had been changed in the same way. Ashcombe General Stores was now General Stores, and Ashcombe Bakery was Bakery. "Them parachutists won't have a clue where they are if they land in our fields now," he said triumphantly as we passed his ladder. "He seems to think he's outwitted Hitler all by himself," muttered Auntie Rose when we were out of earshot. "I think it might take a bit more than Will Eaves and a paintbrush to stop a Nazi invasion." That evening, as always, while Clover sat purring on my lap, I opened my box of letters. I always kept them in order, with the most recent one on top. But tonight the letter at the top of the pile was from several months ago. It was very strange. I took them all out and checked through them. A few of the others were in the wrong places too. I put them back in order and counted them. They were all there. Had I accidentally put them back in the wrong order last night? Or had somebody else been rummaging through the box?